This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans, or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood to celebrate one more time, as Vernell Bonarice's masterpiece reaches a milestone at Jazz Fest. Hear a moving story about one of Jazz Fest founders for whom a stage is named. Or celebrate May Day the NOLA way. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The show, one more time, went from humble beginnings as a homemade New Orleans labor of love, with a single scheduled performance, to a worldwide theatrical sensation that ran for years. One More Time celebrates its 35th anniversary with a special showcase performance at Jazz Fest Thursday. The show's creator, Vernell Bonarice, recently sat down with WWNO's Fred Kasten to talk about some of the origins of One More Time.
New Orleans actor Vernell Bonarice's first professional theater experience came in the touring company of a show called The Book of Job.
Since you're sitting on a bus or sitting in a van most of the time, I started writing One More Time. And I also noticed the interest from other people in the music. I would have old Bessie Smith songs and Ma Rainey, and I'd say, oh, listen to this one. And they would, and they'd really get a kick out of it. And I thought, you know, this is more than just my self-interest. This could actually be interesting for a whole new generation.
What had turned you on to that material?
Mostly my friendship with Orange Kellen, who I met at the Cafe Creole. I was a waiter in my college days, and he was out in the patio playing music. And he and Lars Edgren and Clive Wilson, a bunch of foreigners, were there and sort of keeping the music interest. Through those guys and through the musicians that they knew and the old musicians they were bringing in from retirement or just people who hadn't played in a long time because they couldn't find work. I got involved and interested in that kind of music.
Bonarice also became convinced, courtesy of the great stories his grandmother told him about nights at the Lyric Theater in New Orleans, of the entertainment and cultural value and importance of Black vaudeville and early 20th century African-American theater. While Orange Kellen worked on the music for One More Time, Vernell Bonarice began to put the show together. He recruited singers Topsy Chapman and Thais Clark and actress Sylvia Kumba Williams for the cast.
So the four of us got together, started rehearsing these tunes and working on dialogue that I had written, and we took about 6 months to get it all together for a one-night-only show, which was at midnight at the Toulouse Theater. And the musicians as well, after about 3 months, the musicians started coming in. And again, everybody was rehearsing for free, and the sets were built in my patio, you know, the sort of New Orleans Saturday afternoon. Right. I'll cook some red beans and rice and get some beer, and you come over and nail and paint. Right. And we did, and we made a set, and the costumes were from a secondhand store on Decatur Street. Joanne Clevenger had a store, and I went to her to rent them, and she said, well, let me just see what I can do. And she became a costumer through that. So everything was very homemade and very local and just people caring about something that really was going to happen for one night only.
And how did that night go?
Oh, it was spectacular. It really was. We didn't think we'd get a crowd. It was an incredible rainstorm. And Russell Rock, that owned the theater, had given us the theater for free at midnight because he wasn't using it. But he started his film series late, so around 11:45, it was like, Russell, you know, we got people standing outside. And so we were able to hurry up and put up the set in 20 minutes, which was just one-piece set, so it wasn't a big deal. Lighting was coffee cans. It was just homemade. And that's why I'm so proud of it, because people's efforts paid off. They believed in something, and they held hands and went together against the wind. And a lot of negative, you'll never achieve, you know, no New Orleans show has ever gone from New Orleans to Broadway. So I don't know what your dream is, but so to stand there on the West End and be a sellout hit and have a Royal Command for performance for the Queen, that to me was like the ultimate point of success.
Vernell Banneries, Topsy Chapman, Thais Clark, and an all-star array of other singers and players present the 35th anniversary celebration of One Mo' Time at Jazz Fest Thursday afternoon for 89.9 WWNO. I'm Fred Cassidy.
When New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival first began in 1969, it was radical. Here in the South, still reeling from the civil rights movement and race integration, the festival's founders, Quint Davis, George Wein, and Allison Miner, created a safe space for New Orleanians to come together, to hear each other's music, and to party together. Eve Abrams brings us this profile of Allison Miner, a titan in New Orleans music, and the only person with a jazz festival stage named for her.
For many people, I confess, like me, Allison Miner was a name attached to the stage inside the grandstand, where musicians talk more than play. But then I started meeting people like Grant Morris, who became close with Allison when she managed Professor Longhair for most of the 80s. Grant calls Allison
one of the most important people in music history, and the history of people who aren't musicians.
The first time Grant interviewed a musician on the stage Allison invented, Music and Heritage, he introduced himself as the interviewer. Allison was furious.
I got off the stage and she looked at me, and I'll tell you something, if you're on the wrong side of Allison, you knew all about it. She looked at me and said, "Don't you ever do that again. Don't you ever get up there and introduce yourself."
For Allison, it was the musicians who should be at the forefront, always. And this stage was the place to hear their stories, which she thought were just as essential as hearing them perform. Allison managed the Wild Magnolias, Rebirth Brass Band, Steve Mazikowski, and most infamously, Professor Longhair. She was part nurturing mother, part hard-nosed businesswoman, and there was no line between the musician and herself. They were like family. Mary Lynn Costa, one of Allison's dearest friends, says food was a big part of her relationships. She collected musicians' recipes in a file cabinet and notebooks and hosted them around her large rectangular wooden table with the leaves extended to fit whoever was there.
She felt that around the table and that communion is what needed to be shared, because that's where you really learned who a person was. You know, sitting, actually sharing their food with them, learning about their hardships of the day, understanding who their family was, what really made them sing.
Have you something within you, oh Lord, that's holding the reins? Something within you, oh child, you know you can't.
Allison herself was a startling, beautiful singer. Growing up in Daytona, Florida, she sang backup for her friends Dwayne and Greg Allman, who went on to become the Allman Brothers. She moved here when she was 17 after hearing Danny Barker on TV say New Orleans was a city that cries when you're born and celebrates when you die.
You know I met God one morning, oh Lord.
New Orleans was Allison's great love. She did move away twice for Andy Caslow, her husband, who for several years was Professor Longhair's bandleader.
You know, I told Allison I needed to leave New Orleans, and she was, of course, heartsick about that. And she did not want to leave. She loved New Orleans. She loved it maybe even more than she loved me.
Allison couldn't stay away from New Orleans for long. And when she returned, she took up her mantle as a crusader for musicians, seeing they were paid fairly, treated well, and received their publishing royalties. She wouldn't let anyone exploit them. Mary Lynn Costa.
What'd you say, dogmatic is the nicest way to put it? Oh, no, she was not going to let go of whatever had to be done.
She'd get up in your face and let you know what she thought.
Festival co-founder Quint Davis.
And shake her fist and just whatever. I mean, she wasn't one to mince words. She wasn't one to back down. She didn't suffer fools, and she didn't suffer foolishness. That's just how she was. Maybe because, you know, she didn't have time, as it turned out, to be superfluous about anything.
Alison Miner died at age 46 of bone marrow cancer. By that time, she'd started the Jazz and Heritage Archive, helped launch WWOZ, and ensured that the Jazz Festival would be a non-profit and part of a foundation. After she died, the Music and Heritage stage was named in her honor. It's still the only Jazz Festival stage named for someone.
Now when you go to Jazz Fest, you see the stage is called the Alison Miner Music Heritage Stage, and hanging at the back of the stage is a giant full-length portrait of Alison with a microphone in her hand. She would have absolutely been horrified to see that. She would have been mortified.
Maybe Grant Morris is right. Maybe Alison wouldn't have wanted her name to represent the stage whose entire purpose was to showcase musicians. But the people who knew her know it's perfect. Alison believed that the soul of the music was the soul of the musician. Hers is a spirit well worth remembering by name. For WWNO, I'm Eve Abrams.
You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Are you looking for something to do before Thursday's kickoff of the second weekend of Jazz Fest? Well, my next guest just may have something to whet your appetite. Jean Nathan is the executive director of CANO, the Creative Alliance of New Orleans, which is gearing up for its first May Day party with the raising of the Maypole celebrating a new and expanding arts district in the Ninth Ward. Jean, welcome to Inside the Arts.
I'm so happy to be here. I love your show, and I love the arts, so it's always fun to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. You are starting a brand new tradition, smack dab in the middle of Jazz Fest.
Why not? A lot of people, the real sort of diehard fans of Jazz Fest, come for both weekends, and they stay during the week, and I'm assuming, and I hope I'm right, that a lot of them want to get around the city and see other things, go to the museums, check out some of our attractions. And we kind of want to steer them out into the neighborhoods to experience a little bit of our creative city away from the core areas that the tourist normally goes to.
Now, you're calling the event May Day NOLA Way. This is an art home tour?
Well, generally speaking, we do art home tours at various times of the year and also on a custom basis for private groups. But May Day literally falls right in the middle of the two Jazz Fests. And the minute we said May Day, it just sparked all these visions of the May Day pole and the ribbons and the glitter. And, you know, this is New Orleans, so we can't resist ribbons and glitter. So we said, oh, yeah, let's make it a May Day party, May Day NOLA Way. It has to be done our New Orleans way. So we thought about doing the tours through various areas and then ending up in one location and having kind of a wrap party, in a sense, at the end of the tours, based on the May Day traditions, which go all the way back to pagan times. And we kind of did our history a little bit to see what it looks like. And we started building the event around these old traditions.
So this is the European tradition of welcoming spring?
It's more than welcoming. The way back spiritual underpinning was the idea of soliciting the spirit of nature to help make sure that the harvest would go well, that the fertility of human beings would go well. It was kind of speaking to the gods. You know, in the early days of religion, the idea was to solicit really nature in a lot of ways to support people's goals.
And in New Orleans, we're celebrating the arts, and you're spotlighting the St. Claude Arts District and the Holy Cross neighborhood.
You know, there's so much going on below Canal Street. It is just amazing. And what's so interesting about it is that the neighborhoods below Canal Street were really the ones hit the hardest by Katrina, with the exception of Broadmoor and Lakeview. But the 7th, 8th, and 9th wards were very hard hit, more on the bayou side or on the lakeside, so to speak, than on the riverside. But everywhere down there was flooded badly. And so it's kind of amazing that there's been this renaissance and this whole new art scene down in that neighborhood. It really wasn't long after Katrina that the first galleries in the St. Claude area opened up. And they were run by artists. All of them are still run by artists, and they're on a co-op basis. And they show really amazing and beautiful art. And the only trouble is that a lot of people still don't know that they're there. And so one of the things that we like to do is really help artists, support them in sustaining their career through their creative products. And so we'd like to bring people to the galleries. And there's about 20 galleries that are open down in that area now. The work that's being shown is beautiful and not expensive. You just have to kind of be willing to explore a little.
So can you tell us, where are we going on the tour?
The tour begins on Wednesday at 3 in the afternoon. And I know that's a little odd, it's during working hours, but that's, again, targeting the visitors who are here for Jazz Fest. But it continues on through 8 o'clock at night. So you can start, say, at 5 o'clock when you get off from work and you can go. And we start first in the St. Claude area. And we go to the Good Children Gallery, the Antenna Gallery, and the front. They're all down as you're approaching the bridge over the Industrial Canal. They're kind of down in that last stretch of St. Claude, most of them. And then the May Gallery is over on North Robertson, right as you go up over the high rise that goes over the Press Street Bridge. So that one's a little bit off the beaten track, but worth going over to. And then you go over the bridge and you turn right and you're in a neighborhood of the lower Ninth Ward. Some people call it Holy Cross. It's based on the fact that there was a big Holy Cross school there at one time. So in that neighborhood, we are visiting artist studios and homes. And so we're visiting Rashida Ferdinand, who is a beautiful artist, and she makes art with different medium, including ceramic sculptures, as well as two-dimensional works that she hangs on the wall. So it's a really nice variety of work. Bruce Davenport Jr. has become kind of famous lately. He's been traveling the world. He's been to Japan. He does these marvelous paintings of high school bands and his own personal experience in New Orleans as a young man. And he shows it on canvas. And he's quite a character. So he's fun to visit in his house. The L9 Center for the Arts, that is run by Chandra and Keith McCormick, and they're photographers. And then the Global Greenhouse, which is that model greenhouse that was built after the storm to kind of give us the idea that as we rebuilt after Katrina, we should really think about building green with, you know, solar panels and thermal heat and green roofs and all that kind of stuff. It will be open also, and it has its own little art collection inside. And it's always interesting to see that house and get ideas for how you can reduce your energy costs. So they're included. And then we end up at a place called the Art House on the Levee. That's on Dauphine Street, just where the Industrial Canal and the river meet. So we end the whole thing at that house, and that's where we're having our May Day party.
And this is where you're going to erect the maypole.
Yes, we are. Janelle Vernardo is with me from the Creative Alliance. Let me have Janelle describe what the pole is going to be like, because she's been working on it.
We are going to use a PVC pipe. We're going to decorate it with beautiful flowers, ribbons, Mardi Gras beads, hopefully. Beautiful glittery type decorations just to make it fun and make it a great experience.
Wow. What are you hoping that people will take away from this unique experience that's just typically New Orleans?
I think that the fun spirit of New Orleans is so infectious. A lot of people tell me they've visited here once or twice and that just New Orleans calls to them. So this is kind of another shout out, in a sense, for New Orleans.
All right. Jean Nathan and Janelle Venardo, thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Jean Nathan and Janelle Venardo of the Creative Alliance of New Orleans. For more information on tomorrow's May Day, the NOLA Way celebration, you can check the website cacno-la.org. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. Legendary saxophonist Edward Kidd Jordan is acclaimed internationally as one of the true master improvisers still performing today. Jordan, recognized as a jazz maverick back in the 1940s, is being honored today on International Jazz Day by the New Orleans chapter of the Jazz Journalist Association as the city's inaugural jazz hero. The award is being bestowed in conjunction with the Jazz Journalist Association's annual Jazz Awards, honoring significant and journalistic achievements in the music. There will be a reception following today's presentation of Mr. Jordan's award at 5:30 this evening at Café Istanbul, 2372 St. Claude Avenue. The event is free and open to the public. And Kidd Jordan and the Improvisation Arts Quintet will perform at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, Zatarain's WWOZ Jazz Tent, Thursday at 1:25 p.m. Congratulations, Kidd Jordan. Well, that's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at wwno.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.